This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Thursday, the 3rd of May. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Dean Arcuri. Following the rules announced by the IAAF last week, creating a new classification for female athletes with differences of sexual development, we explore what this means for the intersex athletes and the intersex population as we talk to Intersex Human Rights Australia. These new rules specifically target athlete Caster Semenya, whose body doesn't fit within the normal range. But most elite athletes are not within the normal range of bodies. They all have some sort of advantage over what is considered normal. We don't ask tall basketball players to shorten their legs, so why is it okay to make any athlete take medication which lowers their testosterone level? Does that really seem fair? And with the Victorian AIDS Council celebrating its 35th anniversary this year, we touch base with Cal Hawke from Joy and Vax program Well Well Well, which is looking back on the rich history of the Victorian AIDS Council, how it's influenced us, guided us, and helped us to stand up for our health on all levels and to make Victoria's LGBTIQA+ communities stronger.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
The International Association of Athletics Federation, or IAAF, the World Athletics Governing Body, announced new rules last Thursday, including a new classification for female athletes with differences of sexual development. In other words, intersex athletes. This means intersex athletes will be required to lower and maintain their testosterone levels in order to be eligible to compete in international competition. This is an issue for intersex athletes who present with both typical male and typically female sex characteristics. To be clear, these rules that the IAAF have announced are only for specific athletic events, including mid-distance running, events run by Caster Semenya. The IAAF has tried to introduce similar rules previously, but they were overturned in 2015. In order to provide better evidence to support the implementation of these rules, the IAAF commissioned a study on the effect of high testosterone levels in female athletes and found the unfair advantage that this might produce. It found that, in certain events, female athletes with high testosterone levels benefit from a 1.8% to 4.5% competitive advantage over female athletes with lower testosterone levels. There are two problems with the validity of this research. As pointed out by Dr. Karkazis in Publications, the IAAF has funded, analysed and published this data themselves. It's research specifically designed to support their argument and therefore isn't impartial. The second problem is with the data itself. The report authors ran their test 43 times to come to their conclusion. For example, when you do a statistical test, you flip a coin. And if you flip a coin enough, you'll eventually get heads. If you do enough statistical tests, you'll eventually find the result you want. What does this kind of classification and segregation mean for not only intersex athletes, but the intersex population? We spoke to Morgan Carpenter, Co-Executive Director of Intersex Human Rights Australia, formerly OII Australia, about what these kinds of rules that define a person's eligibility based on the levels of testosterone in their body mean for intersex athletes and the intersex population. Because now it looks like there are guidelines that are created to exclude them from competing at their best and put them in a position to only be able to compete by taking medication that'll regulate their bodies.
Intersex is a word for a whole range of different variations that mean that somebody was born with a body that doesn't fit medical norms for female or male bodies. So we have sex characteristics that don't fit medical norms. And there are at least 40 different intersex variations, each with a very different impact on somebody's body, including genetics, gonads, genitals, and other issues. So we're really diverse. We're an astonishingly diverse population. The IAAF and the IOC, they're only concerned with a very small number of intersex variations. And they are intersex variations where somebody... Well, they're really concerned about this notion that if intersex women compete, then that means that endosex, non-intersex women, are going to suffer. So they're only concerned with a small number of intersex variations.
The International Association of Athletics Federation, or IAAF, has recently come under fire since releasing its new regulations for the female classification, specifically focusing on athletes that show traits commonly found in intersex people. Although there are typically separate categories for men and women in sport, when it comes to the category of women, there's been persistent concern around the issue of fairness, especially when it comes to the variation of athletic ability, something not found amongst male competitors.
Sporting competition has, for many decades, problematized the bodies of women athletes. So an Olympic official, a US Olympic official, in the 1950s, this guy was called Norman Cox, was talking about how the IOC should create a special category of competition for unfairly advantaged hermaphrodites who regularly defeated normal women, less skilled, childbearing types with largish breasts, wide hips, and knocked knees. And so there is a very long history where the bodies of women who don't fit stereotypes of what it means to look like a woman have been targeted.
Regulating intersex athletes may be more difficult than it seems and raises many questions.
How do we know if an athlete has higher than typical levels of testosterone? If a woman athlete has that level. I mean, that might be picked up in doping, but if you look at the history of the way the guidelines have been used, they've been picked up when doctors or other officials involved in events identify some kind of deviation from norms for sex characteristics. So look, they're looking for physical characteristics that appear to be unusual or less common in women. So they're specifically looking for people that are essentially non-conforming. And often that's associated with some degree of either gender non-conformity or just a disinterest in fitting Western standards of what a female is supposed to look like or supposed to dress like. And we see some of the same kinds of assertions made even about, you know, amazing black women tennis players. You know, there's all sorts of language that is used about their bodies and their femininity or perceived masculinity that is also quite horrific. There have been instances where white European athletes have talked about themselves as being the first white athletes to cross the finishing line. So there's very clearly an intersection here between how women are supposed to look and what it means to be a black athlete.
Although there are differences athletes do accept and categories that they're willing to work within, the difference between intersex women and non-intersex women is far from the difference found between men and women.
There is agreement that men have a performance advantage in athletics over women. And the Court of Arbitration in Sport heard that was between 10 and 12% a performance advantage. Nobody is complaining and nobody is saying that intersex women have a performance advantage that even comes near that. The claims that the IAAF was making was that there's between a 1% and 3% advantage, which is pretty marginal, and that's comparable to many other kinds of advantage, like athletes who are able to metabolize oxygen better or athletes that have a higher pain tolerance. So there's all sorts of advantages that athletes have that are not being exploited in the same way here.
So what's the solution? Will intersex athletes be allowed to compete with other men and women without constant concern surrounding fairness? Will they be forced to undergo medical intervention? Or will they be treated as an entirely separate gender identity, unable to compete amongst their peers? It all seems a bit ridiculous when you break it down in this way, doesn't it? Because this is the athlete's body. They're not doing anything other than competing with the tools that they've been provided to live their life every single day. When we draw a line in the sand and say, you're on the unfair side because of the way that you were born, can we really call this fair?
One of the issues that is happening here is that intersex children in global north countries, in high-income countries, and even in many middle and low-income countries, are subjected to medical intervention early, which can have consequences for how our bodies function for the rest of our lives. And in some cases, the women that are competing in sport have discovered through these rules are people that have not been subjected to that kind of medical intervention. And what we're being shown in these rules is quite blatant. It's what happens to intersex people the world over, that we are forced to take treatment as infants or children or adolescents, or later in life, we're forced to conform. And at the same time, we can see that clinicians have, in some ways, adapted to a legal environment where some countries have created a such classification. And what they're doing now, what they're saying in these guidelines, is that either you are forced to take the treatment or you will be othered and excluded as a member of a third sex or as competing with men. So this is really, you know, the way that intersex people are treated in our societies writ large. We are, at the same time, normalized by medicine. We are forced to be either female or male. And at the same time, because of the construction of these new categories legally, we are othered as neither female nor male. And this tears people apart.
We're speaking with Morgan Carpenter, Co-Executive Director of Intersex Human Rights Australia.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
In sport, where many competitions are separated into male and female categories, what defines an athlete as eligible when looking solely at their testosterone levels can create a problem. The IAAF new rules create a problem that is almost exclusively experienced by those intersex athletes wishing to compete in the female competition. There's a belief that the main advantage male athletes have over female athletes is the level of testosterone their bodies produce during physical development. Intersex athletes often produce higher levels of testosterone than non-intersex female athletes. The argument is, therefore, that allowing intersex athletes with high testosterone levels to compete in female competitions gives them an unfair advantage. But most athletes are not within the normal range of bodies. They all have some sort of advantage over what is seen as normal. We don't ask tall basketball players to shorten their legs, so why is it okay to make any athlete take medication to lower their testosterone levels? Sex is the only recognised category of discrimination in sport. We acknowledge that there's a difference between male and female bodies, and we don't make them compete against one another, because it would be unfair to female athletes. But it's time to acknowledge when it comes to the intersex population, changes to the rules need to be made, but not ones that further alienate. Look, there's therefore a precedent for making rules based on sex characteristics, but is it really creating a level playing field for all athletes to be able to compete? Or creating an alienating environment where athletes who may or may not be intersex and sit outside the presumed box that is acceptable are left with one option: to take drugs to regulate your body to fit these guidelines, or possibly even surgery, instead of being able to compete at the range that you've trained for and lived your whole life? Rachel Tyler-Jones continues our conversation with Morgan Carpenter, Co-Executive Director of Intersex Human Rights Australia, formerly OII Australia, as we look specifically at the rules that have been created that affect Caster Semenya from competing. Is this discrimination? Does Caster Semenya even have an intersex variation? It's time we look at the ethics of creating rules and structures, as well as reporting on the validity of people's bodies who are part of the intersex population. And the current state of affairs regarding Caster Semenya highlights this.
I think really what we see with these guidelines is that one athlete is being singled out for quite horrific reasons. Some research was published by IAAS clinicians that identified five events where they claimed there was a statistically significant advantage for women with hyperandrogenism, like high levels of testosterone. Now, the research itself has been contested because it looks like the results that they've got are an artifact of the way they've done their analysis. So other people, for example, publishing in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, have contested those outcomes. But they identified these five events, including the hammer throw and the pole vault. But in the guidelines this year, they have a different set of events. They've excluded the hammer throw. They've excluded the pole vault. They've included a couple of longer track events. And those are events where Caster Semenya competes. So it does seem like it's very focused on one particular amazing, hardworking, talented black South African athlete. But we've never had confirmed publicly that Caster Semenya has an intersex variation. So the whole nature of these guidelines, it means that they are de facto outing Caster Semenya, and that's ethically quite problematic. Really, what they're doing is targeting one particular athlete, and they are targeting intersex women. So therefore, they are making this connection that this athlete has intersex variation when she has never confirmed that publicly. So there's all this press coverage about Caster Semenya. It kind of assumes that we know facts about her body and her life, but we don't actually know. And this kind of speculation about her body is not one that we would accept from very many people. We don't know that Caster Semenya is intersex because, I've seen at least two or three different versions of test results that are claimed to have been leaked that give very different accounts of her body. And really, people should not be sharing that information because it's not public information. It's not confirmed, it's not verified. There is this difficulty with the new IAAF guidelines because the guidelines use the word intersex. The guidelines use a clinical term for intersex called differences of sex development. So they're very tightly focused on women with a small range of intersex variations.
Caster Semenya is obviously a very famous example in this scenario. Are there many other intersex athletes competing that we know of?
Well, you've qualified that by saying that we know of. As you can tell by the way that Caster Semenya is treated in the media, there are not many athletes that want to put themselves in that position. There are athletes that have been through this situation facing Caster Semenya before. There have been athletes like Santi Soundarajan in India who attempted suicide because of the humiliation involved in excluding her from sport. There are athletes like Maria Jose Martinez Patino, a Spanish runner, who a couple of decades ago was found to have XY chromosomes and androgen sensitivity. That was disclosed publicly. She lost her home because she lived in this kind of athletic facility. She lost her career. She lost a relationship. She lost pretty much everything in her life. So this is kind of what happens. I mean, when women in sex variations are discovered in this sporting environment for these sporting purposes, they are not people that have gone through this kind of internalized process of identity formation, of self-discovery, of coming out. They're people that are suddenly discovered to have what is framed as a medical condition, and their worlds are torn apart. Now, to say that a woman in that situation who has been assigned female at birth, has been socialized as a woman, who identifies as a woman, should compete in some category for people with a different gender identity is it's like telling you that you should all compete in categories that do not match your gender identity and your sex. So the idea that we need to protect women's sport from these women athletes with intersex variations, I don't think stands up to scrutiny, because this is just such a tiny range of events. Having all kinds of women compete, all kinds of women who have lived their lives as women, having all of those women compete does not create any, you know, whole-scale problems. I mean, I've seen claims, for example, that having intersex women compete will end women winning medals, but that's just completely ridiculous when you look at the small number of events that are singling out.
That was Rachel Tyler-Jones reporting with Morgan Carpenter, Co-Executive Director of Intersex Human Rights Australia.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Cal Hawke, thank you for joining me tonight on The Informer. We are discussing a segment that you're doing on Joy 94.9 and Victorian Aid Council's show Well, Well, Well.
Yeah, it's more than a segment, really. It's actually a series of episodes that we've started doing in the lead up to VAC's 35th anniversary, which is coming up in July this year, which is very exciting.
That's a lot when you're thinking about looking back. I mean, we're coming up to Radiothon here at Joy, and we're looking back at 25 years, and that's a little bit daunting. But when you look at an organisation like the Victorian Aids Council and look at 35 years of history, that not just internally, but as far as advocacy, health and fighting for health and what it's meant on political levels, grassroots levels, there's a lot when you look at what that means from a VAC perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, the VAC's legacy and its history isn't like sort of self-contained in this tidy box, because as I started to produce the first episode, which we aired a couple of weeks ago, I realized that I actually had to jump back to the 70s. And it was great because at the time I was producing this, we were kind of hot off the heels of Mardi Gras, and everyone had been reflecting on, you know, the 78ers and the legacy there, and 40 years reflecting. And that's related to what was happening here. Mm-hmm. And you realize how much of this is woven in on each other. And it's been great because I've had a chance to talk to so many amazing LGBTI community outers, and some people who have heard their name, or I've met them once in passing, maybe during the AIDS conference in 2014. But to really start to put those connections together and kind of realize it's been really, really interesting to kind of see. And then people that I've sort of taken for granted, I guess, to some extent, that I knew in the community that were still active, but I didn't realize how far back their legacy really went. And it's been really, really lovely.
It's also very daunting when you really consider the depth of what you need to look at. When you're looking at sexual health, even going back 5 years, it's a completely different framework for what it exists for our communities just within Victoria. But when you're going back 35 years,
yeah,
that's something completely different as well, because that's even at the height of the AIDS epidemic, or
and
just
it's,
before
and it's
it?
Really interesting, because when you look at that, you know, I was talking, for instance, to Colin Petrucci, who's the director of health promotion policy and communications of VAC, and he was involved in his early 20s with VAC in the early days. And I was talking to him about sexual health, because we sort of think, oh, this has been an evolution and it's always been just sort of going straight forward. But the interesting thing is that he actually talks about how, coming out of sort of gay and lesbian liberation and the discussion around sexual health, there was actually this huge amount of stigma around sexual health that came into place because of HIV, and how that didn't actually really exist in the same capacity in the 70s, because, you know, you were talking about things and it was sort of like, okay, well, if you've had syphilis and chlamydia, I think Colin says, you know, I guess that was sort of a sign that, you know, you were very popular. It didn't have the same stigma that sort of came along later. And that was really because of HIV and the fear around that. And, you know, we're still chipping away at that.
Well, it's more than chipping away when you kind of look at that of where we are now. Now we're getting news articles telling us, you know, everyone's got to be concerned about PrEP. Mm. It can lead to super gonorrhea. So it is really interesting to look at these, you know, two different spaces of time when we're still, yep, focusing on the same issues.
And that's the thing, too, is that I think that looking at modern day applications of it. So tonight's show, we're looking at activism and advocacy as a framework. And, you know, if you look at PrEP, for instance, in particular, you see echoes of that. And we start to unpack, you know, how we responded in the 80s, and does that model still apply now? And in some instances, things do, but in other instances, they don't. You know, obviously around access to treatment, the stakes were incredibly high in the 80s, when literally people are on the streets because they're saying, look, this needs to happen now, because these people don't have any more time. With PrEP, it's a bit of a different timeline. And obviously, HIV is a chronic manageable illness, as opposed to really what it was when you really truly talking about AIDS in the 80s.
So you're also looking at things in that regard, but are you looking at the organization as well? Because 35 years of history and what that organization is, there's a lot of scope there also.
And it's really interesting to unpack what that organization is, because the understanding of VAC, and I mean, admittedly, VAC was called for a very long time the VAC, Gay Men's Health Center. Mm. But I was talking to Jamie Gardner about this, and there's, as he's going through his archives and looking at it, that organization was established from the very beginning. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that it was actually being formed with, we will tackle this, but the idea is that we put a framework in place that addresses human rights and, you know, addressing those barriers between the broader community's health and well-being needs. And that community has expanded with time. You know, it was largely gay and lesbian focused then, and definitely lesbian presence from the very beginning. Alison Thorne is a persona whose name comes up time and time again because she actually prompted the formation of VAC. But it's changed, and it's really what we call the social determinants of health, and the remit of the organization has really gone to encapsulate that, as HIV has become, like I said, a chronic manageable illness, and we're addressing the other health needs because they're out there. There's tons. Yeah.
And it is really great when you look at the fact that it has always been something that's been meeting the human rights needs that exist on a huge platform. But a lot of people don't understand that, which is why I think it's great that this series is occurring, and it's looking back at our history and what actually exists within it. And then we can compare how it relates to now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a point for reflection for the organization and a great opportunity to really tap into those people. I mean, really, and if I can be on a more somber note, as we were storyboarding this, you know, you go through the timeline and you talk about access to treatment and the introduction of treatment officers and helping people understand. Because, I mean, you talk to some of these people and they sound like they're microbiologists or immunologists. And they had to be because the stuff was happening so fast. They had to be up to speed on it because
they had to learn.
Yeah, the community was trying to make sense of it. And one of the people that I wanted to interview at the time was Tony Maynard, who, of course, actually just recently passed. He was sitting on VAC's board and passed away. And I even said in the production of the first episode that it was actually very sad because it was a reminder that with those people, we basically bury a volume of our history. And I guess I feel like this sense of urgency. Now, not that I expect everybody to die, heaven forbid, but it's just one of those things that you never know, and you lose those chapters, and you lose those lessons, and that's a real shame. And so I've been over the moon to work on this.
Well, then it's absolutely wonderful that you're creating this series and you're using the platform here that we have at Joy to be able to look at our history, share our history, and keep a record of that.
It's been an honor. Well and truly, and ever since.
Well, we look forward to hearing it tonight on Well, 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 and you can download the podcast with the series and lots of other fantastic information from Victorian AIDS Council. Kel, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
We'll listen into Well, Well, Well. You're on The Informer.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you've got a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Dean Arcuri.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.